at the center of this documentary is really one figure. David Martin is at the center of this documentary making some incredible claims. This is some of what was discussed in Plandemic.
We maintained a series of inquiries into every individual, every organization, and every company that is involved in anything that either blurs the line of biological and chemical weapons or crosses that line in any of 168 countries. In 1999, there were 1 million patents digitized by IBM. And those 1 million patents were the first time human innovation had been put into an electronic digital searchable format. We took that information and we did a very simple exercise using our linguistic genomics technology, where I made the horrific assessment that approximately 1/3 of all patents filed in the United States were functional forgeries, meaning that while they had linguistic variations, they actually covered the same subject matter. In 1999, patents on coronavirus started showing up. And thus began the rabbit trail. In 2003, the Center for Disease Control saw the possibility of a gold strike. And that was the coronavirus outbreak that happened in Asia. They saw that a virus they knew could be easily manipulated was something that was very valuable. And in 2003, they sought to patent it. And they made sure that they controlled the proprietary rights to the disease, to the virus, and to its detection, and all of the measurement of it. We know that Anthony Fauci, that Ralph Baric, that the Center for Disease Control, and the laundry list of people who wanted to take credit for inventing coronavirus, were at the hub of this story. From 2003 to 2018, they controlled 100% of the cash flow that built the empire around the industrial complex of coronavirus. On April the 25th, 2003, the U.S. Center for Disease Control filed a patent on the coronavirus transmitted to humans. Under 35 U.S. Code Section 101, nature is prohibited from being patented. Either SARS coronavirus was manufactured, therefore making a patent on it legal, or it was natural, therefore making a patent on it illegal. If it was manufactured, it was a violation of biological and chemical weapons, treaties, and laws. If it was natural, filing a patent on it was illegal. In either outcome, both are illegal.
Well, it is my honor and pleasure to bring on David Martin for this discussion. David, thank you for taking the time today.
Dell, it's an honor to join you.
All right. I want to say something right up front, because just simply by playing those clips, by even saying the word plandemic, odds are that this entire interview will be taken off of Facebook immediately. It may even shut down the channel permanently. We're always at risk of that right now. So I want to say to my viewers out there, if you have not taken the opportunity, please go to thehighwire.com and sign up with our mailing list, because we are not going to shy away from these discussions simply because we're being threatened by social media platforms. Go to thehighwire.com and sign up to our email list so that you can always find us. Now, I want to say this too, David. Just because I bring people onto the show and I discuss documentaries does not mean that I believe everything hook, line, and sinker. These are important discussions, and they have to be thorough, and I think that you've done a brilliant job of laying things out here. But for those fact-checkers that are watching right now, I want to point out that David Martin should be on MSNBC and Fox and every major network right now being asked the questions that he's being attacked about from this film. It's unfortunate that the High Wire is one of the few places that this can happen, but we're going to have a thorough discussion. I just want to say to my audience that what we're going to discuss now are theories put forward by David Martin. Just because I'm interviewing him does not mean that I support these statements. I want to be clear on what the High Wire is because we have so many new viewers. We are a part of an ongoing investigation into one of the most confusing moments in science and world history. There are those that say that this virus is man-made, others that swear it's natural. I personally am still on the fence, and I have brought on scientists from both sides of this conversation. And as I've told you before, I do very little work pre-interviewing my guests and figure out what I want them to say. I want a natural conversation. I want to ask the questions, and I want to allow the people that come on this show to thoroughly share their perspective and where they're coming from. I want to make that clear that what you're about to see, and I know this seems ridiculous to a lot of you. Why is he doing this? Because I'm tired of being censored. I'm tired of being taken down for doing what I was allowed to do when I worked on CBS, if I was allowed to tell the story. Pharma, our sponsors, let us do the story. We were allowed to talk about it. We live in a time now where we are not allowed to ask people conversations. I want to remind you, I believe it was Barbara Walters that, you know, sat down with Khomeini or, you know, and other leaders like Gaddafi. That does not mean that the reporters supported Gaddafi or regimes like Saddam Hussein. We interview because we're curious. And I, Del Batry, am a curious citizen in the United States of America where free speech is supposed to reign supreme. So with one of the longest and most boring caveats in world history, let me start out this conversation with you, David Martin. First of all, when I watched this film, it blew my mind. And the statements, especially when you talked about, you know, the legalities around whether it's natural, a natural virus that's been patented or, you know, a bioweapon, either way it could be illegal. We're going to get into those discussions first. But what I did not get from the documentary is, who are you? Where do you come from? What is it, you know, when I watch television, I have seen you as a financial analyst of some kind on CNBC. You talk about, you know, investments and finances and hedge funds. Can you explain to me what the heck a financial advisor or, you know, specialist on Wall Street, how do you now find yourself in the middle of a discussion of the origin of a virus that is the heart of one of the strangest moments in world history? What is your specialty that puts you here?
So, Del, it's actually funny, and you have to go back actually quite a long way. And I know everybody thinks this is a new thing. It isn't. This has been around for a long time, and I've been involved with it for a long time. In fact, a long time for me goes back to 1991.
Okay.
In 1991, I was somewhat discovered at the time as a graduate student at Ball State University, as having a very unique capability of speaking science to the capital markets. Back in 1991, what that meant was that we were working on the very first clinical trials at the time for measuring cholesterol using reflectance photometry. Most people will forget that cholesterol wasn't really a thing until the Framingham Heart Study got published. And in 1990 and 1991, suddenly everybody wanted to get tested. Sound familiar? Yeah. We didn't know it was a thing. Then it had to be a thing. And in a very unusual set of developments, I happened to be someone who both had the physiology training as well as the ability to speak about the commercial consequence of the measurement of cholesterol at that time into the capital markets. And so I was kind of one of those anomalies that actually could speak science on one hand and balance sheets in Excel on the other hand. And that gave rise in 1992 to the first formation of a medical device clinical trials organization at the University of Virginia, which is where I went for my PhD and ultimately joined the faculty of the medical school at the University of Virginia. But we set up the first clinical trials, for-profit clinical trials center on medical devices for the FDA. And we went on for a decade running clinical trials and everything from MRI technologies to large-scale treatments of pain therapies, all sorts of modalities that had to do with chronic, both orthopedic and rheumatoid conditions. We had an enormous amount of work in the first combined drug device submissions in the history of the FDA, which was using inert gases to measure the effects of contrast enhancement for MRI across the blood-brain barrier. So I was the pioneer of medical device clinical trials for the FDA for a decade. In fact, we were at that time working directly with CDRH at the FDA. We were working on breast cancer technologies from Russia. We were working on I-128, iodine, and gadolinium and other forms of diagnostic agents that were both drugs and devices. So I spent a decade doing clinical trials and running those at the University of Virginia through a company at the time called IdeaMed. We did some of the largest clinical trials on medical devices in U.S. history. And so that decade concluded in 1998 when the United States government and specifically the Small Business Administration realized that there was a fundamental problem in the banking world, which was people were not able to understand how intellectual property and intangible assets supported commercial credit. And my company, MCAM, was set up as the world's first and still to this day the only entity that has the ability to provide regulatory capital relief for banks using intangible assets, patents, copyrights, trademarks, things that are actually intangible assets, as regulatory acceptable collateral in the markets, which gave rise to an entire business that we're very well known for, speaking about innovation and the role of innovation in the capital markets. And for those who are not familiar, it's worth noting that our systems are what officially measures the leading economic indicators for the U.S. and the global economy, the Innovation Alpha Indexes, published by the Conference Board. So our company is the official measure of both U.S. and international innovation economies, and we've been that since the 2015 creation of the CNBC IQ 100 Index.
Let me just read that really quick. Hold on one second, David. We found that how we created the CNBC IQ 100 Index of Innovation Leaders. Today, CNBC unveils the CNBC IQ 100 Index, a first-of-its-kind rules-based index of large-cap companies that derive substantial revenue growth through the use of protected proprietary technology. It is powered by MCAM International, a firm that maintains an unprecedented archive of documents related to patents, trademarks, copyrights, and other intangible assets from 160 countries. Now, I'm not a big finance guy, but from a layman's perspective, am I to understand that while a lot of people analyze the liquid assets, the financial background of a company, valuing it there, that your specialty is looking at the types of proprietary things that they own, patents they own, and giving some sort of quantifiable understanding of what the value of those things are?
That's right, and we are the only ones in regulated capital markets across the entirety of the world to actually underwrite them. And Dell, what's important for your audience to understand is that underwriting starts with a fundamental question, which is, do you actually own what you say you own? That sounds like a simple question. But when it comes to a thing like a patent or a copyright or anything else, it is more nuanced than you might think. And that is because in the pursuit of patents, in the pursuit of copyrights, it is very frequently the case that you will find that companies or agencies or individuals misrepresent or seek to influence the law in ways that are actually not legal, which is how we get, in a very direct way, oddly enough, into this conversation.
It reminds me of, I work a lot with Robert Kennedy Jr., on the discussion of vaccines, and people will say he's not a doctor, he has no business here. But what he'll say is that I'm an environmental attorney. I spent my life defending or fighting against chemicals and properties. I read journals and medical journals and can read a medical study as a profession. It's a part of the profession that I have. So when people started handing me medical references and journals discussing mercury in vaccines and things like that, it wasn't like I didn't understand that. I have been fighting and I'm very good at, reading those technical journals. In this case, though, it revolves around finance, and people try to write off he's just a finance guy. You read patents as probably the larger part of what you do, which is the central part of what the pandemic discussion is, right? What is patented?
Well,
where did they come from? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, and it's important for people to realize that as a member of the medical school faculty at the University of Virginia, right? So this is not, you know, medicine is my training. It is my background. And I spent many years on the faculty. So when I talk about clinical trials, I'm not talking about them in an abstract sense. I did submissions to the FDA. I worked on the CDRH panels. Right. So these are things that are professionally part of my life, and I have a very long and published legacy in doing it. So this is not an avocation for me. But when it comes to understanding intellectual property, and when it comes to the forensics around intellectual property, we add one more credential. In the early 2000s, the United States Treasury deputized me individually and contracted with my corporation to lead criminal and civil penalty inquiries into what at the time was one of the largest tax frauds in U.S. history, which was a scam perpetrated on the United States Treasury by corporations who willfully misrepresented their intellectual property positions. So we've been both involved in civil and criminal proceedings with respect to that. And as is the case now, it was very, very popular for agents of those companies to seek to disqualify me at the time as just a medical guy. So the funny thing is, you know, when I was taking down bad guys, I was just a medical guy. And when I'm now taking down bad medical people, I'm just a finance guy. So I think somewhere in the middle, I think I've landed probably in the middle of the fairway.
So then I was going to, my next question is going to be, you know, then you are used to some adversity. Plandemic is arguably, you know, one of the most controversial films in the world right now. It's getting censored. You are under attack by multiple publications. Let me just ask you right now, how many news organizations have had you on the show, whether it's NBC, ABC? I mean, these are networks that might have had you as an analyst before. Has anyone really asked to have you come on and defend or discuss the issues around Plandemic?
No, we have been only corresponded with specifically by the New York Times. When we filed the Office of Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services complaint in April, we started showing the evidence that we were providing in that particular proceeding. We showed that evidence to the New York Times, and we have had not only email correspondence, but one very extensive phone conversation about this. And the article has yet to appear. The only other media outlet that has come out is that we did receive from a USA Today fact checker fellow. We received an email after Plandemic came out. In that email, we responded to a series of information disclosures that they had, and then they published the factcheck.org smear campaign without making reference to a single thing that we had actually sent them. So that those are the only two mainstream media inquiries we've had. And it's important to put that in contrast to the fact that when we took on the patent case with respect to the EpiPen scandal several years ago, my op-eds were the subject of CNBC publications. I was on camera. I was on air. And that was the exact same type of forensic investigation we're doing now. But obviously, the political overtones were very different, and we were successfully able to lead a very dynamic assault on the EpiPen price gouging exercise. And as you know, that ultimately wound up in favor of families who desperately need to keep their kids alive after allergens.
So let's get in. I think that, you know, one of the things I want to do here is give you an opportunity that you're not getting anywhere else to answer to these fact checkers. Now, I thought Plandemic did a great job already discussing fact checking, where it comes from. So many of these organizations don't even have a doctor or a patent specialist. They make phone calls, and expert says, well, this is what's going on, and they take the expert's word for it. You're an expert. Your expert opinion doesn't matter. So clearly, fact checkers are just opinion checkers, and if it doesn't match their opinion, then they write you up. It's a really crazy world we live in here. It's leading to book burning, censorship. But let's go through some of these fact checks, shall we? Just to sort of, I want to hear what you have to say about it, because they raised some interesting questions. This is the factcheck.org, new pandemic video peddles misinformation. Martin runs a company called MCAM, which analyzes patents and intellectual property to estimate the investment value of companies. The pandemic video shows footage from Event 201 with references to travel restrictions and misinformation, for example, next to footage taken during the actual pandemic about those same subjects. Coronaviruses are a family of viruses, and experts who have known of the pandemic threat posed by coronaviruses for years. So it's not surprising to those who study such outbreaks that a preparedness exercise would have centered on a coronavirus. Martin claims that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saw the possibility of a gold strike when the SARS epidemic arose in 2003. Skimming across the screen while Martin makes that claim is a headline for a November 2003 news story about the race to patent the virus. However, that story doesn't support his argument. It actually explains that the CDC wasn't pursuing the patent for profit. Rather, it was doing so to keep others from monopolizing research. Similarly, the director of the CDC at the time, Dr. Julie Gerberding, told reporters that filing for the patent was a protective measure to make sure that the access to the virus remains open for everyone. Okay, so they are saying that your claim that they were trying to own or make money off of it. We are hearing a lot about NIH patents involved in this vaccine that are going to make scientists, you know, millions and millions of dollars. You know, that's not the part. You're not talking about NIH. But what do you have to say to this idea that the CDC, first of all, didn't patent it to control it, patented it to free it up?
Yeah, that's a beautiful piece of absolute crock of shit. Sorry, but that's the bottom line. Let's review a tiny piece of patent law first. There's a thing called Section 102 of the 35 U.S. Code, which is a law that basically says that you can't patent something that has been published in an enabling disclosure in the public domain. Now, in 2003, April 25th, 2003, when the CDC filed its patent application, it could have done something else. If it wanted to keep it from ever being patented or commercially exploited, it could have simply printed the SARS coronavirus genome. By doing so, it would have placed it in the public domain, making any patent on it ever in the history of humanity illegal. Patents are not to defend the release of information. Patents are for commercial exploitation, which means that if you file a patent, what you're saying is that for the next 20 years, you want to control the commercialization and the commercial consequence of your innovation. So let's on its face state that if the CDC filed a patent to release something into the public domain, that would be a misapplication of the patent law, and it would be a waste of taxpayer money at the minimum. But here comes the bigger problem. The bigger problem is what they said in the article you just quoted is a lie. And it's a lie because on September the 7th, 2005, the United States Patent Office agreed with me. They said, you're not entitled to a patent on this because the information you're seeking to patent is in the public domain. Therefore, no one can get a patent on it. It's called a Section 102 rejection. The CDC wasn't happy with that. And so they submitted a series of filings. And in May 2006, the Patent Office wasn't convinced. And the Patent Office issued a final rejection. That final rejection.
Let me get this straight. Let me get this straight, because I just wanted, before we get too deep, CDC then, if I'm not understanding, the CDC is saying we filed a patent so that some company couldn't grab a patent and keep anybody else from getting near it.
Right.
We wanted to make sure that all the great scientists of the world would always have access. Therefore, that's why we filed the patent. And what you're saying is the patent got rejected because the patent office said This is already protected space. You are not allowed to patent, just like nobody is, because these remain available to the public because it's part of the public domain. So they clearly went out of their way to get it out of the public domain and make it their own.
Well, and let's be clear. I'm not saying this. This is their documents. And this is where your disclaimer falls apart, Dell, because I haven't stipulated an opinion once. I'm reciting from their own legal filings at the United States Patent Office that I happen to have copies of. You can't make up an opinion on the fact that on September the 7th, 2005, the CDC was told you submitted something that has 99.9% homology to what is in the public domain. Therefore, you don't get a patent. And they protested, and they came back and said, no, 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 no. We are entitled to the patent that you just told us we're not entitled to. And even after they said that, the patent office was unconvinced. And on May the 5th, 2006, the patent office came back and said, you're still wrong, people. You are not entitled to this patent. And the CDC, again, not only came back and appealed that decision, but they filed an appeal to overrule the decision of the patent examiner, who would not relent on this point, by the way. The patent examiner did her job. She did not relent. But they went over her head. And they ultimately got a patent granted on the genome, and this is important for everybody to listen to, for the genome called SARS coronavirus, which is the subclade of the beta coronavirus that we're talking about today. And everybody who wants to jump through hoops about, well, this is a different SARS, this is a different coronavirus, this is a different fill in the blank. The problem with their argument is for it to be SARS coronavirus, which is kind of the front end of SARS-CoV-2, for it to be SARS coronavirus, it has to have a high homology to the existing and patented version of coronavirus. So everything about what the CDC said in their public statement is falsifiable on their own evidence. It's falsifiable in patent law itself. They are not allowed to actually file a patent on something that's already in the public domain. And as I stated in the film, and as I routinely state, it's also a violation of Section 101, which is a bigger problem, because Section 101 of 35 U.S. Code says that patents on nature are not legal.
All right. So I want to, and let's hold it right there. Before we jump in, I want to, this is because I would say when I was watching the whole thing, you know, I'm watching the documentary, making sure I'm ready to talk to Mickey Willis. This line jumped out at me. To me, it was the biggest statement in the entire film. We've already played it in the larger package, but I want to bring attention to this. Take a look at this.
Under 35 U.S. Code Section 101, nature is prohibited from being patented. Either SARS coronavirus was manufactured, therefore making a patent on it legal, or it was natural, therefore making a patent on it illegal. If it was manufactured, it was a violation of biological and chemical weapons, treaties, and laws. If it was natural, filing a patent on it was illegal. In either outcome, both are illegal.
Okay, so there's huge issue being taken with this. This is what the Fact Checker article had to say about it. That next, Martin claims that federal law wouldn't have allowed for a patent on that isolated virus. Again, he's wrong. Instead of reading from the U.S. patent laws, he says he is in the video, Martin reads from a 2013 U.S. Supreme Court decision. That's an important distinction, since the decision which changed one aspect of patent law that's relevant here came 10 years after the CDC filed for a patent related to the virus that causes SARS. While the Supreme Court did find that a naturally occurring DNA segment is a product of nature and not patent eligible merely because it has been isolated, that decision came a decade after the CDC sought the patent. So it sounds like the fact checkers are saying here that you are right, you can't patent something that's natural, but you were making the statement as though that has always been the case, but this was a new finding that this patent was legal at the time it was patented because the Supreme Court had not ruled that that nature is unpatentable. That didn't happen until, what did it say, 2013. What is your response to this?
Well, that's actually one of the most easy layups. That is putting it right in front of the green, because what it shows you is the fact checkers are not familiar with the division of powers in the United States. Okay. The Supreme Court does not make the law. 35 U.S. Code Section 101 was written long before the Myriad Genetics case, and 35 U.S. Code Section 101 predates the CDC filing. Nature cannot be patented, period. Now, the fact that people sought and ultimately obtained patents on nature is in fact a fact that has been going on ever since the United States Patent Office changed its business model to issue patents and then have them contested after the fact. It's a good business model when you get to print forgeries and collect revenue for those. But the Supreme Court, in their own decision, which is what the fact checkers should have bothered reading, which we know they didn't, the Supreme Court bothers to point out that they have long held that there is no way to patent nature.
I have it right here. Let me read it. We have long held that this provision contains an important implicit exception. Laws of nature, natural phenomenon, and abstract ideas are not patentable.
Yeah.
There you have it. Long held seems pretty clear. It's not saying we are.
Yeah, and so listen, I mean, you've seen this, Dell. You've seen this with the way people misquote the Jacobson case in vaccinations, right? People sit there saying, well, the Jacobson case clearly showed that the Supreme Court says you can mandate compulsory vaccination. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Jacobson case was about a $5 fine, not compulsory vaccination. And that Jacobson case turned on the fact that he didn't want to pay the fine or get the vaccination.
Right.
And basically what the Supreme Court said was, if you're not going to get the vaccination, you can be charged a $5 fine.
As I pointed out to Alan Dershowitz, right? Right. Alan Dershowitz says, Jacobson means I can forcibly eject you. I said, no, it doesn't. It means you can charge me a fine. Holding me down, pinning me down, and piercing my body and injecting a toxic chemical into me outside of my will has never been upheld in a court. So
assault and battery is not a police state power. You're not allowed to do it. But here again, we have a situation where the fact checkers almost get it right, except they're hung on their own little noose here. And here, let me tell you what's wrong with their argument.
Okay.
Let's give them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay.
Let's say for the sake of argument, I've got it wrong. And the CDC was justified in patenting nature, even though it's against the law in 35 Section 101. Let's say they're right. Here's the tiny problem. Their patent came up for renewal, which is something every patent does, and it came up for renewal in 2015, which I think fact checkers would be willing to submit, is 2 years after the Supreme Court declared these patents illegal, and the CDC repaid the maintenance fee to keep the patent. So even after it was declared illegal, they re-upped the patent. Every single fact that is laid out in their public, their legal record shows that they are lying and willfully, in 2015, willfully breaking the law. Because if it was a question before 2013, and even if we grant it was, which it wasn't, because the Supreme Court said we've long held that these are not legal. But even if I'm wrong about that opinion, they still broke the law in 2015. There's no way. And that's why I love the fact checkers, because they actually teed it up.
Right.
They said,
Perfect.
Well, he might have got it wrong. Well, okay.
All right, let's move on.
Wrong,
okay. all right, I think that we would be, at least I'm willing to say that, to me, the Supreme Court saying we have long held means this goes back in time. But you're right, even if it didn't mean that, 2015 comes after that that decision. Now, what about the next part? After that, here we go. Here's the next fact check. And it's a part of the same thing. You said that you can't patent nature, but Martin takes his claim one step further, saying if it was manufactured, it was a violation of biological and chemical weapons treaties and laws. If it was natural, filing a patent on it was illegal. In either outcome, both are illegal. That's the video clip that we showed. That's not right either, said Artie Ray, a professor at Duke University School of Law, in a phone interview with factcheck.org. Lots of things have been patented over the years that would be illegal to use, said Ray. She gave the example of devices for taking illegal drugs, explaining that having a patent on something doesn't give you the right to use it. I guess she's referring to some sort of pot pipe or something like that is the same as a biological weapon. It sounds like apples and oranges, but let me do a better job for them because I think that this may be more of a sticking point for me. You are saying that patenting a SARS coronavirus is illegal either way. If it was natural, you're not allowed to do it, but if it's a potential biological weapon. But I would say this. I focus on vaccines all the time, MMR vaccines, The MMR, like, it's the mumps strain of the vaccine that Merck owns. That allows them the patent. They attached measles and rubella to make a vaccine so that they could claim the market. But they own the patent to the mumps strain of the virus. Vaccines are made because these companies own patents to what appears to me to be natural elements that you could argue they're using it to make a biological weapon because mumps could be a very weak biological weapon, but you get the idea, whether it's chickenpox or measles or any of these things. These companies have been patenting these things for a long time. How do you decipher? I think the CDC could easily say it wasn't for a bioweapon, it was for a future vaccine that the world is going to need. So you're making a claim, and it seems to me you're missing a middle point. What if it's not a biological weapon? It's not, it's not nature. Maybe they've adjusted it just enough to get through the patent office, but they're going to try and make a vaccine in case we're attacked by a biological weapon. Shouldn't the CDC be allowed to do that?
No, see, that's the problem. If it was a therapy, or if it was a detection, or if it was something that was actually for the laudable reasons you just laid out, then one can very easily make the argument that detecting ricin or detecting anthrax or detecting Ebola or Zika or fill in the blank pathogen, detecting any of those things is actually a very laudable thing to do. It's actually in the public interest. Here's the problem. The problem is that beginning in 2005, all of the parties that we talk about, and by all the parties, I specifically mean the National Institutes of Health, DARPA, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and others specifically began looking at how the coronaviruses could be combined to increase their pathogenicity. That's where the line crosses.
Okay.
You are not allowed under biological and chemical weapons treaties and conventions, you are not allowed to take an active agent of nature and willfully increase its pathogenicity. That is the reason why we got into things like the Nuremberg trials, the ultimate Nuremberg Code, and the biological and chemical weapons treaties that followed. It is not a matter of legal action to engage in the increased pathogenicity of any pathogen for any reason. And it's really important that we get this distinction, Del, because the problem is that in 2005, we knew in published documents that DARPA saw both offensive and defensive capabilities of using coronavirus as a pathogen of war. This was not some sort of what if we get attacked. This was actually a recognition that this thing could be chimerically altered to achieve strategic battlefield and warfare implemented benefits. Now, once again, CDC is not entitled to play around with the chimeric and recombinant alteration of a pathogen to make it more lethal. That's not ever authorized. It never will be authorized, and it is actually the violation I speak of. Part of the reason why the Supreme Court and part of the reason why 35 U.S. Code Section 101 is so explicit on saying that the technology of nature is a technology, yes, that can be understood and exploited, but it must be used as nature, not patented. And if you patent that nature and then you seek to commercially exploit it, and the way you go about exploiting it is by starting to recombine and chimerically alter a pathogen, that's where you cross the biological and chemical weapons gray line into a bright line violation.
I think that that makes sense to me, and it's something that, you know, I feel like there's this place in humanity, especially in the United States of America, where we think we have really, you know, we're sort of above the rest. We mean well for the world, you know, we do what's right to try and protect the world. But I feel like deep down, this really, we shouldn't really even be having to have this argument, because I bet you if I stop everyone on the street and say, do you think that our government secretly uses viruses and works towards developing potential future weapons? Do you think that they do that? Even if I, you know, they may not know, I could stop someone and say, you know that it's illegal to make a virus into a weapon, right? They say, oh, yeah, even though you know that they just heard it for the first time. But if you ask them, do you think the government does it anyway as a way to potentially protect us in the future? I think that most people would say, of course they do. I mean, that's what we do, yeah. Right? We know every country has spies. We know that they break rules, they break laws, and that's just what we do. We look the other way. But when it comes to these issues, I think where, you know, it starts to get really dicey is we were used to all the discussions about nuclear weapons, right? We look at Iran. We got to get into your facilities. We got to see what you're doing there, because nuclear energy, I mean, it's really similar, right? Nuclear energy, okay. Nuclear bombs, not okay. Studying a natural virus in case it ever, you know, breaks out across the country to make a vaccine, okay. Making that virus or taking that energy to do some harm, not okay, right?
Well, in 2013, let's remember that the National Institutes of Health came to this conclusion. This is not Dave Martin's conclusion.
Right.
The National Institutes of Health came to the conclusion that what was being done on gain of function and chimeric alteration of coronavirus was crossing possibly both legal and ethical lines. This is not me opining on it. This is the National Institutes of Health, the check writers themselves, who themselves said that they felt that they had probably blurred or crossed lines. So don't, you know, this right. is not Dave spinning the story. This is real policymakers who came to the conclusion that this shouldn't be done and came to their own recommendation of shutting down the programs on their own. So I am reciting facts. I'm not making them.
Okay, so let's get to then I think those were all, you know, fairly clear defenses. They make sense to me. Someone else can try and take that deeper. But I, for one, as a reporter, I think you've done a good job of making that clear. Clearly, the Supreme Court ruled that we've always said that you can't patent nature. And you make sense in, since they're already admitting maybe we should stop doing this, that there was a problem. But here's my issue. I mean, I'm still going to say Plandemic was powerful. I'm not sure, does the film definitively set out to say this is a man-made virus that was released upon the world? I'm still on the fence. I think that what you are presenting, what Plandemic and other scientists, I'm hearing more and more, and I'm interested in this conversation, but a lot of it's circumstantial. A lot of it is still circumstantial evidence. So let me just ask you for your opinion. Do you believe that this is a man-made virus, and do you feel like you have enough proof to make that statement?
I think that if you look at the transition of funding in 1999 from the 10 years of research where coronavirus was focused on cardiomyopathy in rabbits, and then recombinant research on coronavirus started looking at the amplification of the S1 spike protein, the open reading frame around the receptor binding domain, and the ACE2 receptor as a target of amplification. I think it is reasonable to say that the human species, and by the way, I'm now quoting from patents filed by these individuals. So these individuals include Ralph Baric, the CDC, and Moderna. I think it's important to realize that these individuals made a point of saying that coronavirus has historically not been a pathogen of major concern. And then, beginning in 1999, and between 1999 and 2003, we see the amplification and modification of two strands of coronavirus. And suddenly in 2002, going into 2003, we have the first SARS coronavirus outbreak. Now, we've got a linear problem with the way we tell stories. Karl Popper was famous for talking about the error of historicism, and one of his arguments is that we have a very linear view of things. We think that things start and then they tree and they kind of branch out from a single root. What we don't contemplate is the possibility that people who were doing research on the combination of coronaviruses in bat populations, who themselves were going into bat populations and exchanging information biologically with bat populations, we don't have a postulation even at this point in time that suggests that bats could have been cross-contaminated with what humans were doing. We have this theory, and the way the theory goes is that coronavirus was highly mutagenic. It does all kinds of adaptations. And suddenly in 2002/2003, somehow some bat populations got next to humans and we had the first outbreak of SARS. The inconvenience of that story happens to be the fact that for 3 years we were actually focused on the things that ultimately nature seemed to mutate. I'm very careful about trying to ascribe blame or credit to whether this was a human-derived or a zoonotic-derived or some sort of in-between. But I do think that it is tragically ironic that if you look at the bat SARS-CoV populations around the world, which predominantly, according to Columbia University, find themselves in the Seattle area, in the New York area, in northern Italy, in parts of Iran, and in several parts of central China. I do think it's interesting that all of the outbreaks have occurred where zoonotic transmission studies have been taking place, where researchers are going into bat caves and bats are coming out of bat caves. Now, that doesn't make it causal. I'm not stating at all that it is a unidirectional thing, but I'm also not stating that when you have human-animal interactions, our illusion that things can only go one way clouds our thinking. We have an ability, and we've seen this, by the way, in the craziness we do when we mess with mutations in nature, we have an ability to amplify mutations that nature then goes on and amplifies more. So can you blame a bat? Can you blame a person? I'm actually not sure that's a constructive question even, because at the end of the day, what we know is that, to your earlier point in this show, when humans start messing with nature, we often don't think of the consequences. And so is it the case that researchers interacting with bats may have cross-contaminated bats? Well, that's plausible. I'm not saying it is or isn't the case, but I do find it alarming that when we went to identify the unique attributes of SARS-CoV-2, and if you look at the ICTV publication, which is the World Health Organization's International Committee on the Taxonomy of Viruses, and you look at how they made the distinction of what type of coronavirus subclade this SARS-CoV-2 was, they specifically harvested unique populations of known bat colonies and decided that the homology was based on known bat colonies. So this was not a mysterious bat cave that somebody stumbled across. This is a bat cave that was pretty highly trafficked in the past, and the samples that were collected happened to match the ones that allegedly came out of Wuhan, China in December of 2019.
And samples now, we have to imagine were going and being taken into laboratories, right? They're using them.
We know that that was going on, and we know it was going on through federally funded research for many, many years. And that's the reason why I'm so cautious about this, Dell, because it's important for us to recognize that we've got to break this notion that nature just happens immune from our effect on nature.
Right.
The fact is that we may contribute to natural, you know, mutations. We may contribute to nature changing its own course. And that's why I think that the question of the provenance of the mutation is somewhat secondary to the fact that, to your earlier point, we mess with nature at our great peril because we don't think about the collateral consequences of our actions very often. And after the fact, we then try to back ourselves into a story to make it look like we were the victims and nature was somehow the perpetrator.